ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Remember that Black Mirror episode where you're scored on what kind of citizen you are? For renters, that already exists. Real estate platforms are now collecting up to 50 points of data on anyone who wants to rent a home. I'm Ray Johnston, and on Download This Show, I'm investigating what rental tech is doing to your chances of finding somewhere to live. To hear the series, search Download This Show on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. The National Film and Sound Archive has added YouTube clips to its collection, which, no shade at all, the internet is very much a part of our culture, but it's also huge. How do you archive it all? That is in the next 20 minutes. Also ahead, it is a huge and growing section of the publishing industry, and one that you are maybe tempted to look down your nose a bit at. But when it comes to romance novels, the tide might be turning. August is Read a Romance Month. Soon you will hear from two women who literally have PhDs in romance about where this genre should fit on your bookshelf. And if you've got recommendations, I want to hear them. It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, when I say the word gamer, what springs to mind? If you're picturing a teenage boy virtually shooting at strangers while his mum sets the table for dinner, you might need to update your cultural references. Because actually, gaming isn't really that niche. According to a new report from Screen Australia, 78% of Australians have played a video game in the past 6 months. It's a sizable industry that brings millions into the economy. But unlike other creative industries like film, television, and music, we don't often talk about the cultural value of games, how they make us feel, the stories they can help us explore, the people they connect us with. So I want to hear from you. If you are one of the gamers among us, tell me what your favorite game means to you. What role do games play in your life? And do you feel like the people around you get it? And here with me in the Life Matters studio this morning are independent video game developer Luke Musket. If you have ever lost hours playing Fruit Ninja, you have Luke to thank for that. And Associate Professor Brendan Keogh, Chief Investigator of the Digital Media Research Centre at Queensland University of Technology. Brendan, Luke, welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Brendan, I might start with you. I mentioned some stats from that Screen Australia report. You helped put together some of the audience research on that. Can you give us an idea of how into games we are and why we're drawn to them?
Yeah. So first off, it was a very big report of a lot of different teams working together. It was a really great thing to be a part of. But yeah, like games in Australia are really being played by people of all ages and genders, which often very much surprises people. Middle-aged people, women and men equally, more or less. All sorts of different games from your mobile phones to your PlayStations, PC, etc. But yeah, really, they're really just as common as music or film for people in people's media lives. The main reason people said they were playing them was mostly for entertainment and fun, which isn't that surprising. But then you see also the other really big ones were socializing with others, which was especially really big during the pandemic and since. And then telling stories, I think, was about 48% of respondents said that's why as well. So there's still a pretty big part that see it as kind of a cultural artifacts as well.
What does the Australian part of that industry look like?
Yeah, it's interesting. So it's a massive global industry. And in Australia, it's overwhelmingly smaller studios. We've seen a lot of growth since the late 2010s for all sorts of reasons, but partly thanks to the growth of digital distributions and more affordable tools for small teams to use. And so in Australia, we have a really vibrant ecosystem of small teams making experimental indie titles and very popular mobile titles, such as previously mentioned Fruit Ninjas. And yeah, it's a really, in some ways, quite precarious. Like it's quite similar to music is the analogy I would often use, like bands where some are doing really well, a lot of, you know, having a lot of fun, but maybe aren't paying the bills with it. But there's a lot of just exciting experimentation happening.
Well, how did you get your start, Luke?
It's an interesting question because when I was growing up, it didn't even occur to me that you could get a job making video games. Like it didn't even occur to me that humans made games in a way. It was just a thing that I played. And it wasn't until I went to like a university open day that they had a little stand set up and it was like, get a career making video games. What? And I was like, that's an option.
Yeah.
So I completely dropped everything else that I was doing and just fully focused on wanting to get into university to learn how to make games. And then, yeah, I did a double degree at QUT and then was lucky enough to get a job pretty soon out of university, because even then it was incredibly hard to get a job in the games industry. Probably even harder today, maybe, even though the industry is bigger. It's, you know, it's, I think it's like the most popular thing that a lot of kids say they want to do when they grow up is making games. And yeah, it's just such a tough industry to get into though.
But you went along to design a game that has since been downloaded more than a billion times. Mm. Like, you weren't foreseeing that at Uni Open Day, I'm guessing.
No, absolutely not. And I mean, it's interesting, like all through, especially my early career, Australia was not the place to be if you were making games. It was very much on my mind, like, do I have to move to the US at some point? And when should I do that? And when will that work for my career? You know, the Australian games industry was really kind of in service of the US games industry. We just got hired to, you know, do work for American companies often. And then, yeah, when it kind of hit the 2010s, like Brennan was talking about, it really picked up and those opportunities came here. And yeah, so it was super exciting that, you know, it is such a big industry here in Australia now.
It's interesting talking about that feeling of like, when do I need to move to the US? It's sort of like that artist's journey that a lot of Australian arts and knowledge workers as well. Brendan, how much of a brain drain are we seeing in Australia?
Yeah, it's a good question. These days, I would suggest less so, but definitely in the late 2000s when we had a real industry collapse, similar to what Luke mentioned before, you know, the Australian dollar, the American dollar hit parity after the global financial crisis. It suddenly, we weren't a cheap place for American studios to send their work anymore. And we saw massive closures and the industry got more or less obliterated. And we saw a massive brain drain back then. And a lot of that talent still hasn't come back because the industry looks so different here now. They can't necessarily find a place. These days, people still certainly go overseas, but we've been able to build that local ecosystem. If you're making an indie game using kind of downloadable tools with for a digital platform like the App Store or Valve Steam on PC, then you can kind of do that anywhere and upload it from anywhere. So there isn't the same pressure to move overseas and find an employer in the same way it used to be. The harder thing, the thing that's hard now is kind of getting investors and publishers to pay attention to Australian games. But I would say we've kind of hit critical mass in the last, again, 5 or 10 years where they do come out here for kind of a big industry events to see what's going on, which makes it even easier to stay here.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm talking to Associate Professor Brendan Keogh from the Queensland University of Technology and video game developer Luke Musket about the Australian gaming industry and what it means to us. I wonder how much time you spend playing games. Maybe you're thinking of sitting in front of a big console with a big shoot 'em up in front of you, or maybe it's just what you're using at the bus stop while you're waiting for your bus to come on your phone. Tell me about the role that games play in your life. My number's 0418 226 576. John says, I'm 77 and a gaming tragic. Thousands of hours on No Man's Sky, played so many over the decades. To me, it switched my mind off everything, concentrating my mind in the sim. It's relaxation. That cultural side of things, Brendan, that's what your research is really looking at. Do we appreciate the art behind games in the same way we do for music or film?
Yeah, I think short answer is no, but it's getting better. I think the answer to those surveys about why do people play games, and it's mostly having fun or killing time being the main ones. But again, the large minority of like storytelling and stuff as well. We often, when we think of video games, in the same way you've kind of caveated this segment, right? Like, we often don't think of video games in the same way. But despite that, they're like hugely significant sites of storytelling and cultural expression, and especially for younger generations who've grown up with video games, for way maybe we grew up with films or whatnot, that they're just, one of the games we looked at was Unpacking by Brisbane team Witchbeam, which was hugely successful when it came out. It's just about unpacking a woman's belongings at different stages of her life in different apartments and houses, and just tells a really subtle story through that. And as part of our research for this project, we looked through all the kind of user reviews of that game and just how much it really impacted people's lives. Like, people thought they were just going to get a time-killing casual puzzle game, and instead they encounter this really affecting emotional story about this woman growing up and kind of finding herself. And that really surprised people that that's what they were getting out of it. So it often sneaks up on us, the realization that there is something culturally important here.
Luke, what sort of elements are you bringing together when you're designing a game?
I mean, there's a huge question because, you know, kind of like we've just been saying, games can be so many different things. And so, you know, in some cases you may be bringing like story and narrative to it and kind of taking a player along like an emotional arc. Or you might be saying, okay, the player can have their own emotional arc and can dictate that and decide where the story goes. And then other games, you know, like Fruit Ninja, are purely about kind of entertainment and the visceral sensation of interacting with something and, you know, potentially the mastery of a skill. And so it's, you know, but what you do end up doing no matter what is you end up working in a lot of different kind of mediums and with a lot of different skilled talent. And so you're working with visual artists, you're working with musicians, you're working with programmers, and then you have production and marketing. And it's an incredibly multidisciplinary field, which keeps it really exciting and really interesting.
So now you're an indie developer. How has that changed how you work or what success looks like for you?
I mean, one of the big ways that's changed is now I have to do all of those roles myself, which means you have to learn a lot, which is actually the reason I started doing it, but it is also very tiring. It's a lot to do. But also being an independent developer means that I can take bigger risks with the kind of work that I make. My costs are a lot lower than a large studio. You know, if you're a large studio employing 200 people to make a game that takes 4 years to make, which is probably like not even large, like that's probably kind of like upper mid-range. You know, you obviously need a game that is going to sell a lot of copies in order to be able to continue to employ those people and fund that. When it's just me, I can take a risk and kind of target a smaller niche audience and really try and provide kind of innovation and like take interesting risks with the creative side of the game and, you know, still be able to eke out a living.
What have people told you? We heard Brennan was talking before about unpacking and people kind of being surprised at their emotional reaction to this. Have people told you what your games mean to them?
Yeah, I get a lot of Fruit Ninja was my childhood, which, you know, makes me feel very old. Everyone telling me about, like, I remember playing this, like, with my brother on the school bus when I was 8 and he was 5.
And you're like, wait, but I'm 23.
Yeah. Exactly. So, but, you know, and it's interesting, games can mean different things to people at different stages in their life. Like, I get messages sometimes where it's like, Fruit Ninja was a great escape for me while I was going through something really difficult. Mm-hmm. And I found like a lot of comfort in that experience of being able to do something where I felt kind of empowered and felt rewarded and felt good about myself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, depending on what you're going through at whatever stage in your life, that will mean different things. But yeah, it definitely means a lot of different things to different people and I think has real impact on their lives.
Yeah. It is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm with Luke Musket, independent video game developer, and Brendan Keogh from Queensland University of Technology. We're talking about gaming and I'm asking you what gaming means to you. You can send me a text on 0418 226 576. So many different perspectives on gaming coming through. Well, different games that people like. One says, I'm a middle-aged woman and I love playing Zelda. Gorgeous, intricate, endless, open world, relaxing experience. Another who's 62 says, I'm a Minecraft tragic. So much creative fun and I get quality time with my godson who lives in London. He's 10. And Naomi in Northern New South Wales says, do word games count as gaming? Wordle, Quirtle combinations? If so, I'm a gamer too. Brendan's nodding. Brendan and Luke are both nodding. Yes, Naomi, you're a gamer as well. Matt has texted in along the lines of saying a huge proportion of the games played based on shoot 'em up scenarios. That's a common perception, Brendan. Is it true?
Yeah, it's an interesting one because there definitely are a lot of violent video games, a lot of video games focused on gun violence especially. It's quite similar to being like, you know, there's a lot of films that are based on violence and action films, right? And I think the thing with video games we often lose sight of is that they're just as diverse as any medium, you know, that there's big Marvel action blockbuster films and there's also, you know, small independent, you know, romance films and everything in between. And video games are very much the same, just the only ones we see on the sides of buses and trams are often the large shooter ones. At the same time, to think of video games seriously culturally isn't just to celebrate them, but it is also to critique them. So there's been some really great critiques from game journalists and researchers around the relationship between like the firearms industry and the military with video games. Like this is going back a decade or so now, but there was a big report on the amount of money firearms companies were paying to have their guns in games, right? Wow. Like for kind of brand recognition for teenage boys, essentially. So while the old kind of media panic of like video games are training murderers aren't true and are incredibly reductive, they don't really rewire our brain in that way. No media does. There's absolutely these complex cultural entanglements there. Again, if we're respecting video games as real culture, it means being critical of what they might do negatively as well as what they do positively.
A text here says, I've been rather shocked to see the ads for alpha novels that you see when playing games online. They seem to me so misogynist. Invariably an impossibly handsome man who women have been ill-treated by their partners find themselves married to. There's also a wolf pack theme in many. Who are they written for? Who writes them? I'm getting quizzical looks in...
Is that about the romance novels?
I think this is to do with video games and books. Luke, what do you say to the violence in video games kind of trope and idea?
Yeah, I mean, I think very similar to Brendan. It's, you know, there are those violent games, but to kind of like paint all video games with that one brush and be like video games are bad because there are violent games would be like saying like all cinema is bad because horror films exist. there is such like a diverse, you know, diverse range of games that can provide so many different experiences. And yeah, you know, some of them are very violent, but that is just some of them. And, you know, it would be such a shame to ignore an entire medium because of just a few games or, you know, a genre of games.
So coming to this idea of like the cultural value of games, which is really what was pointed out in that Screen Australia report and your research, Brendan, what does the funding situation look like in Australia? Are we doing what we should be, you can editorialise here, to support this industry?
Yeah, I mean, short answer is Australia's got an incredible funding ecosystem for games, which is, I would say, developers around the world are incredibly jealous of, which Luke is nodding, so yes, that's good. It's historically, it's been very inconsistent. Screen Australia and the Australia Council of Arts, now Creative Australia at different times, have funded them in different ways. Tony Abbott's 2014 budget, which nobody liked, I think also took away a big fund for the Australian games industry that the Screen Australia had just introduced halfway through with no warning, and that was kind of the death knell of the old industry in many ways. But since then, especially the state governments like Vic Screen in Victoria, Screen Queensland up here, and many others have really stepped up. And Screen Australia in more recent years is doing stuff again. But all of that is largely around kind of giving smaller pots of money to independents overwhelmingly, not just that. And it's making, you know, the risk-taking even less risky in a lot of ways, that, you know, someone can afford to quit their job at Woolies and just try to make that indie game they wanted to make and see what happens because they've got a little bit more of a safety net now. So there's a lot more that could always be done and provided, but in terms of what we have, it's just really supported and grown the ecosystem here. And a lot of people's favourite Australian independent games probably got government funding and have a Screen Agency logo on them as well.
You've received that funding, Luke. What has it meant to you?
Yeah, it's incredible that the opportunity that it gives me to be able to actually make a game and not worry that I'm not going to be able to make rent or anything like that is incredible. And yeah, it definitely hasn't always been the case. In 2015, when we started an independent studio, we had to go on the road and try and raise funding. There was no opportunity really to earn any funding in Queensland specifically. And so we had to go and find like private capital, which then you know, we were really lucky. We had really excellent investors who are actually also other Australian independent game developers who had previously found success. So we were really, really lucky there. But that creates so many different pressures where you can't take those same levels of risk, whereas the government incentives, you know, really does support especially the creative and risk-taking games. Mm.
Sorry, just really quick. It's also been hugely important for equity reasons as well. Like the government funding can often, of public funding, I should say, comes with often like, you know, you need to not be a team all of dudes, for instance, or you're less likely to get funding if you are, or you need a good reason why that's the case. There's been exclusive funds for First Nations people and First Nations game developers. And so there's been all these ways that, but public funding has been a really positive intervention into just developing the industry in a more equitable way as well.
I'm really loving hearing your reading your texts as well on this morning. So many people who just telling me about the games that they love and what they mean to them. One says, I'm a 40-year-old. Gaming is a wonderful reset between family and work. Not just passive, but actively manipulating and exploring the story or world put together by the devs. Shout out to Hollow Knight and Silk Song. Another said, just played through Big Walk with my friends. It's a game made by Aussie indie developers, and it was the best gaming experience I've had in years. Georgia says, I'm a mental health worker and have worked with many teens who experienced positive social connection through games in otherwise quite isolating mental health and social circumstances. So flash forward maybe 10 years, where do you see Australia's gaming industry standing? Luke, I might start with you.
I mean, it's a very interesting question because it's definitely, despite all of the support and all of the funding available, it's definitely hard times right now. The games industry in general is seeing a lot of layoffs globally. Australia has been lucky. We've been much more insulated from that than especially the US, where, you know, a lot of money poured into it over COVID. And now not all of those games are making results. And so, you know, we're seeing like a lot of job losses. I really hope that it will continue to just grow and be strong because I think Australia really like bats way above our average. Like the amount of incredible games, like a lot of the games that you just read out, all from Australian studios. For such like a small industry, we have such an outsized impact globally in the games market. So I hope we just continue to see that grow and improve with time.
Brendan?
Yeah. Likewise, it is a very unstable moment right now for the games industry, which will hopefully stabilize at some point and find a new equilibrium. I think in the future, what's interesting is at the moment is like the super photorealistic graphics that blockbusters have long relied on to sell new consoles or new games. Like that doesn't really sell a new game anymore because your PlayStation 5 game doesn't look any better than your PlayStation 4 game and your PlayStation 6 game won't look any better either. And so what we're seeing, especially the indie space, and then these kids who are growing up playing Roblox and Minecraft and mobile games, is like very different interests in what games look like and what you do in a game and different kinds of... Big Walk's a great example. Like it's a beautiful game and it's also kind of funny and cartoony and we're seeing gamers kind of attracted to those kind of games. Mm. So I would hope in the future we'd see more kind of experimentation in that space and more players really latch onto that as instead of looking for the next big blockbuster, because I think we're getting to the limits of what those big blockbuster games can offer.
Well, Luke, Brendan, thank you both so much for chatting with me today. Luke Musket, independent video game developer based in Brisbane, and Associate Professor Brendan Keogh, Chief Investigator of the Digital Media Research Centre at the Queensland University of Technology. And thank you for your texts as well. Gaming saved my life, said one person. The dopamine rush cured my nocturnal restless leg syndrome, enabling me to get deep sleep. Another says, Ignition gamers in Canberra use video games to teach life skills to neurodivergent teens and young adults. Well, it's Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, when you think of Australian screen classics, you probably think of The Castle and Kath and Kim, maybe The Man from Snowy River. But what about your favourite YouTube video? A new project is looking at curating the best from Australia's digital creators into the National Archives. That's next. Do you recognise these voices?
X squared plus X, does it make much of a difference? This is for all of you looking at your working.
if you wear glasses, everyone is obsessed with trying them on.
That is maths educator Eddie Wu, musician Tash Sultana, and comedian Nat Tran. Even if you don't recognise their voices, they have a combined 5 million followers on YouTube with over 790 million views across their channels where they all started their careers. YouTube is 21 years old. It's long past the days of being full of meaningless cat videos. People who have gone on to make a genuine mark on Australian culture got their start there, which is probably why the National Film and Sound Archive last week announced they were inducting 10 Australian content creators, including the three voices you just heard, into the archive. It's a big step in recognising the cultural contribution of our digital world, but with technology and media appetites changing so quickly, how do we keep up? And most importantly, will my Facebook posts from 15 years ago ever make it into an archive? Well, you're about to hear from the head of the archive as well as a digital culture specialist. But I want to hear from you. What kind of videos do you watch online? What creator would you induct into the official archives? With me is Patrick McIntyre, the CEO of the National Film and Sound Archive, and Professor Nick Carra, Director of the Centre of Digital Culture for Digital Cultures and Societies at the University of Queensland. Patrick, I might start with you. What was behind the decision to induct these creators into the archive?
Morning. The National Film and Sound Archive, we are charged with collecting all forms of recorded sound and moving image. So that goes back to the 1890s, gramophone records, wax cylinders, all the way through. And obviously, for about the last generation or half generation since the advent of digital technologies, most recorded sound and moving image creation, distribution, consumption is all happening online on streaming platforms. And so we've been collecting sample videos from YouTube as far back as 2007, but we really realized that we had to step this up. We had to be more comprehensive in our collecting. We had to look at really collecting the makers having an outsized cultural impact. We needed to collect interaction data like likes, shares, and comments. And so we just decided to give YouTube a call. and that's how the creator capsule was born, was just a shared, you know, it's about time to really shine a light on the impact that content creators are having on the platform.
That's so interesting that you're including likes, shares, and comments in the archive, because of course that is part of the artifact.
It's right. And it's part of the, you know, we're a cultural archive. We're not really a technology archive. So we're looking for all the context around recorded sound and moving image that gives it its culture shaping power. And in previous eras, you know, we could collect reviews in newspapers or we could collect ratings data, but they're all kind of very industrial era types of evidence, of cultural evidence, whereas likes, shares and interactions, that's Australians responding in real time and directly back to the creator and even amongst themselves.
So tell me about the decision to focus on a creator and their sort of whole channel rather than just an individual video.
We wanted to start collecting YouTube more as a phenomenon. So we had been collecting individual videos that responded to, for example, COVID lockdowns, or, you know, we were collecting them as evidence of what was happening in society as opposed to collecting them as the phenomenon of the platform itself. And, you know, where do you start? So that's one of the reasons why we wanted to talk to YouTube, was because they have knowledge of who's on the platform, you know, who's making waves, who's been having impact over a long period of time. And also, you know, working with YouTube on this meant that doors were opened a lot wider and more easily than if we'd tried to do this ourselves potentially. So we're looking for creators who were making high quality material, like a high standard of creative expression and originality and storytelling. We're looking for numbers unapologetically. We're looking for the people who are really reaching audiences across the country and really stimulating conversations. And we're looking for cultural stretch. So the thing about the platform is everyone's on there. Like, you know, network television is on YouTube now, as well as, you know, the people we think of who are, you know, beginners with an iPhone doing their own thing. And so we wanted to capture the full range of of channels and content out there. So, for example, Glitch is an animation studio that now employs hundreds of people. Bounce Patrol, that's a kids channel. You know, they're now an international Australian kids brand, much in the way that the Wiggles are. And Natalie Tran was, interestingly, she was one of the very first kind of YouTube creators in Australia to make it big on the platform. Mm. So we're looking at all those different kinds of cultural markers in an attempt to say, okay, we're going to start with 10. Where do we start?
Nick, when you heard that the National Film and Sound Archive were going to include Australian YouTube creators in the Hall of Fame, aka the archive, what were your thoughts?
One of my thoughts was it's kind of we're past the moment where we thought we'd just try and collect everything on the internet and put it in an archive. Do you know, if you go back 10 years, there was this sort of an attempt to say, like, should we capture everything Australians have posted to Twitter and put that in the National Library? And it's like, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. And then you realise that the internet is just so kaleidoscopic and so crazy and so ever-evolving that this kind of would defeat us both and have huge environmental costs, like the amount of energy you would burn keeping all of that stuff. And so now I think we're finally at the point where it's like, let's ask much more curatorial questions about what's important to put in the archive.
Isn't the internet already an archive?
No, the internet turns out to be like super ephemeral and particularly as our internet cultures move much more towards video and short video. It comes and it goes. And so it's not just literally that things disappear off the platform, but like whole platforms can disappear. Like if you think about all the things Australian teenagers did on Tumblr in the 2010s, and it's kind of gone.
Maybe that's not such a bad thing. You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm with Professor Nick Carra from UQ and Patrick McIntyre from the National Film and Sound Archive talking about the induction of 10 Australian YouTube creators into the archive that was announced last week. And I wonder who you watch on the internet, what videos mean something to you. If there's anyone that you would nominate to be inducted into this archive, Natalie Tran was the GOAT, one of the pioneers of skit comedy online. I remember seeing some of her early videos. They seem simple now, but they felt so fresh. Her drawing a six-pack on with a marker was peak humour in 2010. Another says, I'm here for the meaningless cat videos, not at all interested in adolescent egos. And David from Yipoon says, I Did a Thing is an absolutely incredible Australian channel. His projects are equally awe-inspiring and terrifying. He seems to know what he's doing, though, despite it making it look like he's about to hurt himself. Patrick, how on earth did you only choose 10?
Yeah, I mean, that was a question. It sort of picks up on what Nick was saying. You can't do everything. So you have to develop approaches to sampling what's happening on platform. And as it happens, it's what we've been doing with radio and television for decades anyway. Like, you can't literally copy everything that goes to air on Australian television. So we have been working out ways of, you know, rosters and tuning in. You know, we have a radio capture program which captures, there's a whole broad range of radio stations on the roster, and we capture every minute of Australian radio according to different stations across every day, and we have done that for years. So if you want to go back and find out what the radio news response was to a particular issue, we've got that captured in a number of different radio stations' voices and perspectives. The internet obviously boots that up a huge extent. So we are really self-consciously now doing declared sampling. Like, we have to document for future generations how we went about collecting decisions, because, you know, in generations gone by, the ideal of archiving was you just collect everything and the future decides what's important. Mm. But, you know, as Nick said, that's really not possible, and it's certainly not possible economically or environmentally in the present day.
Yeah, it's sort of like asking your kids to clean out your house once you're gone.
Yeah. That's the approach. It's more, it's why Capsule was interesting for us as well. I think partnering with YouTube has sort of elevated this conversation about cultural archiving in the 21st century, how we need to do it differently to accommodate for the sort of, you know, depthless profusion of creation. It's one of the most interesting challenges we've got. And, you know, also, as Nick says, these platforms come and go. So it's not like waiting you know, I think the sector waited like a good 40 years after video games became a thing to start kind of scratching our chins and going, they're culture, we should collect them. We don't have that amount of time with digital. It comes and goes too fast.
It's funny you mentioned video games as an example, because really taking video games culturally seriously was what we were talking about just before. Nick, do you think people take culture generated on the internet more seriously now than we used to?
I think it's probably partly a generational story, but I think like the idea of saying like culture generated on the internet is something special or new to like a whole generation just makes no sense. Do you know, like culture and the internet are sort of inseparable?
Mm.
So I think like, yeah, there's whole audiences now when they think about what Australian, their experience of Australian culture was growing up, they think of YouTube. Do you know, they don't think of broadcast TV or broadcast radio. It's already the case, I think.
So Patrick, what are the key things you're hoping to capture and preserve?
Look, it's life as lived in Australia. I think that's the main thing. And so some of the, Glitch is it's an animation studio, like, and most of their views come from overseas, and they are now like a production house pumping out things into the cinema ecosystem as well. Whereas other people like, you know, Superwog, for example, they started out doing skit comedy, they now do touring live shows. So we're looking at things that kind of talk to what's happening on the platform, but how, you know, it informs other modes of cultural expression and vice versa. And as Nick says, online culture is actually culture. Like it's where these conversations are happening now.
I'm loving your texts. Someone's voting Michael West for the Archive, the independent journalist. Raka Raka got their start on YouTube with homemade special effects and are now making cinema release movies. So people move through there. Another says, I think that they should archive Keith, a music video by Playlunch. It's a great portrayal of Aussie suburban life. Everyone knows a Keith. This video has 1.5 million views on YouTube right now. I will say, if you're going to watch it, make sure there are no kids in the room. It's bit spicy, but it's very funny. Patrick, you're going to put Keith on in the archive?
Sure, why not? I'm taking notes.
I love it. It's like, yeah, fine, put it in the archive. You must have, what's the filter? Like if someone's coming up to you at a dinner party, Patrick, and be like, I think you should put my son's YouTube on in the archive, how do you decide?
We have curators. So we've got a curatorial workforce and their job is to really keep tabs on what's happening in terms of audiovisual technologies and cultural expression. So it's a kind of a constant monitoring, research and outreach activity for the archive. But, you know, someone's kid's video, that is collectible. You know, all of those instances of publishing on the platform are instances of cultural expression that people in 50 or 100 years' time might find interesting. I always think back to like 19th century pamphleteers. Like people were like handing out crazy pamphlets on street corners the whole time. You know, they didn't take them particularly seriously. They weren't really collected by libraries or museums because they're ephemeral and disposable. But a lot of, you know, female suffrage, a lot of issues were actually being tested, rehearsed and distributed on pamphleting as a platform in its day. We've lost those voices now. And wouldn't we love to know how people were actually kind of approaching those sort of seismic cultural changes generations before they happened? That's kind of the thing. So we want to collect stuff that is beautifully crafted and well produced and has high numbers. But we've also got to just be tuned into some sense of what the marginal voices are doing, what the people working way outside the system are doing. We also at the archive, through our sampling procedures, collect a lot of stuff that, you know, is either offensive now or will be in the future, because that also is painting a picture of who we are now, so that people who come after us can understand how things turned out.
Well, Patrick, Nick, thanks so much for chatting with me. Patrick, I think you should include a Life Matters episode or two in the archive. Patrick McIntyre is the CEO of the National Film and Sound Archive. Professor Nick Carra is the director of the Centre for Digital Cultures and Societies at UQ. And this is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, August is Read a Romance Month. Where do you stand on romance as a genre? Does the idea of reading a happily ever after have you wrinkling your nose or curling your toes? What's your guilty pleasure? Trashy magazines, Maltesers, pimple popping videos. One of my great pleasures, and one that I refuse to feel guilty about, is a good romance novel. They're swoony, they are escapist, but there's something that serious readers, capital S, capital R, have traditionally looked down their noses at. It might be shifting. Romance accounts for a hefty and growing chunk of the publishing industry, and August is, apparently, Read a Romance Month. You're about to hear from two scholars who are also romance authors about where they see this section of the bookshelf heading. But I would love to hear from you two. Where do you stand on romance as a genre? If you're a fan, do you have a book recommendation for the romance curious? But first, Dr. Esme Louise James is a sex historian and author of Kinky History, The Stories of Our Intimate Lives Past and Present. She's also the author of a fiction novel coming out in the next couple of weeks. And Dr. Jodie McAllister has written 9 romance novels and is a senior lecturer in writing and literature at Deakin University. Esme, Jodie, thank you for joining me.
Lovely to be here. Thank you so much.
So you are both smart ladies. You literally have PhDs. You read and write these books. Why, Jodie, do you think they're seen as non-intellectual?
Well, there are a few reasons here. Number one is a little thing called sexism. So while this is shifting, romance has historically been perceived as by women, for women, about women. And things that are by women, for women, about women have been historically marginalized in the history of literature. But even if we move beyond that, romance is about emotion. It's about feeling. It's about sentiment. And often I think we can get a little bit embarrassed about feelings. We position anything that is a little bit too sincere as cringe. And so I think romance has perhaps suffered in the public perception as being cringe, as being too sincere, too earnest to be really serious.
Esme?
I actually want to take that back a little bit further because everything that Jodie said is absolutely correct. But if we actually go back a little bit further in history to the birth of the romance novel, these were very interestingly novels that were written by men, and men of sentiment were considered your really highly attuned highbrow men. It was to be a man of letters and a man of sentiment was a very big artistic acclaim. And so those original romance novels like Samuel Richardson's Clarissa and Pamela, for instance, these were seen as like massive artistic milestones. And what really happens around this kind of 18th century period is that we have the birth of the printing press and rise in literacy rates. And as Jodie's mentioned, as women started to become readers in bigger proportions than we'd ever seen before, this shifts. We go from seeing these novels as highbrow achievements to light and frivolous reads. So by the time that Jane Austen's writing, her work is considered at best a light and frivolous read, and at worst it was considered a danger to the reason and intellect of women. And it's just a remarkable shift that happens only within the course of a century.
That is, I knew there was a reason why we had a historian in the chat, Esme. It's so illuminating. I'd love to know what's the first romance novel you ever read, Esme? Like, what was the book that started it all for you?
Oh, dear. Do you know what? I think that my first romance novel that I can remember off the top of my head would have been a Jane Austen. When I was little, I always watched my mum reading the Jane Austens. And so I remember being about 8 or 9 and trying to tackle it and not really understanding a word. But at the same time, I do remember clear as day walking into her and it was like, Mr. Darcy's awful. Like, why do you like him, mum? And then by the end of it, I've got posters of him in my room.
Jodie, I think when I think of romance, maybe it's just my age or whatever, but the cringe version that I think of is like shirtless Fabio, bodice ripper, that kind of paperback, very sort of cheap and widely available. What's changed? You don't see them in the same way anymore.
So there are a few things that have changed there. So when we think about the bodice ripper, scare quotes around that phrase, we're talking about quite a specific period in the history of romance fiction. We're talking about sort of what we would call the erotic historical novel of the 1970s through to about the 1990s. These are the ones that we think of with Fabio on the cover. But like any market, the market shifted. So those sort of big, bombastic, erotic historicals, sort of turned the volume down a little bit. And from there, we got sort of gentler historicals. Think Bridgerton. Bridgerton is kind of part of the next wave of this romance novel. But there are also some really prosaic shifts in the way books are printed and books are sold and books are imported that are driving a lot of this. So what we see now in the romance market is quite different to what we were seeing even 15, 20 years ago.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm talking to Dr. Jodie McAllister and Dr. Esme Louise Jane, James, both romance authors, both have an academic bent. Esme is a sex historian. Jodie is a senior lecturer in writing and literature. And we're talking about the shift of romance novels. August is Read a Romance Month. According to libraries and booksellers, at least, they've got a vested interest. But I want to know where you stand on romance as a genre, and if you have a book recommendation for the romance curious. And I shouldn't be surprised in the least that you are flooding me with your book recommendations. One said, I read Lucy Walker novels as a young teenager in the 70s, traveling, a train trip, peppercorn country, WA, outback, etc. In our school libraries, Barbara Cartland, Mills and Boone, never heard of. This was my Australia reference. Another says, I didn't have a view either way at first, but now I do enjoy a good romance novel, particularly male-male romance novels. I've enjoyed reading romances so much that I'm currently writing my own romance novel. Another says, Tegan, have you read Ali Hazelwood? Love them. Set in STEM academia, sexy and smart. Yes, I have read them. Thank you very much for reminding me of Ali Hazelwood. But Meg says, I run the book section of a busy op shop with general fiction, classics, health and well-being, cooking, etc., plus romance novels. Romance is the slowest selling category. Jodie, that is at odds with what I hear about what's happening in the publishing industry.
Well, because this is a secondhand bookstore. I mean, this is honestly quite surprising to me as well, but because this is a secondhand bookstore, I wonder if there is something a little bit different going on there. So what we are seeing in romance at the moment is a real romanticization of the object of the book. We're seeing a lot of beautiful special editions coming out, hardbacks, sprayed edges, foil covers, that kind of thing. And so the places that people are looking for their romance novels are perhaps a little bit different than they have been in the past. Previously, romance has been relegated to dark corners of bookstores and op shops have been very, very busy. I've done some work talking to people who are reading in the 80s and a lot of them source their books from op shops. But perhaps what we're seeing there is a little bit of a market shift. People are looking for their romance in different spaces now.
Esme, it seems like a lot of the uptick in romance sort of visibility is social media, book talk. How has this affected how we see it?
It's made such an interesting cultural difference. We did a bit of a survey recently and asked people if they discovered genres like romantasy and everything via book talk. And it's very interesting because a lot of people said no, but a lot of people said that that's where their primary source of discourse is. And obviously with book talk, you have people giving all of their recommendations. There's a new system, a spice system. You put, you know, a certain amount of chilies as you recommend the book to say how much smutty content you're going to get inside of that. But all of that actually goes to drive, I think this, there's always been a huge uptake in sales. And Jodie, you would know this better than me. It's obviously been such a huge seller. A genre for the last few years. But the book talk sales section that you see in bookstores is such an interesting cultural phenomenon where you do know the likes of the Game Changer series or A Court of Thorns and Roses that really blew up because of book talk discourse. They are now like book talk. And I would say like Ali Hazelwood as well probably falls under that category.
Jodie?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's no doubt that romance has seen kind of a spike in sales since the emergence of book talk. But I think the mistake that we make sometimes is thinking that romance wasn't popular before. Mm-hmm. Romance has always been popular. Romance has always been a big seller. I think really the big shift we saw with book talk was more people talking about it openly. We've mm-hmm. really started putting pressure on this idea of romance as a guilty pleasure, something you should feel bad about reading, as junk food for the brain. Now people are really starting to embrace this openly. And I really don't think that this is accidental if we look at the timing. So book talk really started to take off in 2020. I'm sure we all remember what else happened in 2020. And then when we think of the great promise of romance fiction, which is that everything will turn out all right in the end, that you will get the love you deserve, that you know that good things are coming. Of course, this makes sense when we consider what an uncertain period this is. And we see similar kind of rationales around romance if we look back at literary history. So, for instance, during World War II, Milton Boone was one of the only publishers to maintain its paper ration on the grounds that it raised morale for women in the factories. So whenever the world is in a time of genuine crisis, romance always has a way of kind of bubbling to the fore.
That idea of keeping the paper, that I have just shivers, chills at hearing that. Right, Jodie, what kind of themes are readers reaching for in 2026?
Oh, there are all kinds of themes at the moment. Interestingly, I was at the Romance Writers of Australia conference in Darwin over the weekend, and there has been a real, I was very surprised to hear that there's been a real spike just in the last, kind of the third quarter of 2026, in books using the term marriage and crisis in their marketing material, which maybe tells us that we have an appetite for stories at the moment about people who were drifting apart coming back together. But we have some old stalwarts, which are still doing very well. I think things like Enemies to Lovers and Friends to Lovers aren't going anywhere. Romantasy, which is the hybrid of romance and fantasy, still continues to do very well. Historical has kind of fallen off a little bit, but I think it will come back. So romance is a cyclical genre. Things cycle in and out of popularity fairly regularly.
So many recommendations coming through on the text line as well. Amanda says, I usually avoid romance novels, but can now recommend a short series by Australian author with a PhD in the niche area of archaeology. She's L.J.M. Owen. The intellectual thread of the intermillennial sleuth / archaeologist is woven into a thread of the main character's romantic entanglements. Well, I did say before that I would share maybe one or two of my recommendations, but I want to hear from you. Esme, if someone is romance curious, where would you start them off?
Someone's romance curious. I think that you have to look at other factors, right? Because I kind of see romances, it can sometimes be part and partial of other genres. So if you are someone who does like the fantasy world, then you have the romantasy options like The Fourth Wing and A Court of Thorns and Roses. Even your Twilight, if you're someone who maybe goes for, you're looking for more of a titillating read, of course you've got the classic 50 Shades of Grey. Or if you want to go, I feign calling it a romance novel, but even let's go back to My Brilliant Career and the Australian classics.
What about you, Jodie?
I'm going to recommend some local authors. I think we have a terrific romance scene in Australia that sometimes gets drowned out by America. So I would really like to encourage people to read local. Read authors like Nina Kenwood. Her book, The Wedding Forecast, is fantastic. Her new one, People Skills, is just about to come out. Steph Vizard, The Love Contract and A Smart Girl's Guide to Second Chances are both brilliant. Melanie Sayward is an Indigenous author of romantic comedy. Her book, Love Unleashed, is just great. And Patrick Lenton's In Spite of You is a wonderful, wonderful queer romance that I think more people should read.
I loved it.
Oh, Patrick Lenton's book's incredible.
So
I just
good.
Want to second that one.
We're fresh out of time. I'm going to chuck in there Rachel John's The Other Bridget by West Australian author. Well, Esme, Jodie, thank you both so much for chatting with me. Dr. Esme Louise James has her debut fiction novel, Becoming Venus, out next week. She's also a sex historian and author of nonfiction. And Dr. Jodie McAllister has written 9 romance novels. She's also, in her spare time, a senior lecturer in writing and literature at Deakin University. And your recommendations just keep coming through. Jane Eyre was my first romance novel at the age of 11. Since then, I tried Mills and Boone, but they were so formulaic that they were predictable and therefore boring. Fiona McIntosh writes well-researched novels and they are really interesting. The Bridges of Madison County, writes someone else, and I am not a romance reader, they say. Julian from Narrabundah says The English Patient by Michael Unjari. Who says romantic fiction isn't sophisticated? And Jonathan says, is no one going to mention Georgette Heyer? Well, that's just about it for Life Matters. I've come to you today from Jagera and Turrbal Land. Thanks for your texts throughout the show. We spoke earlier about gaming and what gaming means to you, maybe whether we don't take it seriously enough in our culture compared to other things like film or music. One says, my son has curated a section of video games for me. And when he moved away for university this year, he set us up to play online games together, which has been a lovely way to spend time together virtually. We've started playing Big Walk, which is beautiful, with Australian landscapes and cooperative, no shooting. I've also really enjoyed Baldur's Gate 3 and Clair Obscur. I'm amazed at the depth and complexity of stories and the range of music, story, characters, and activity. We also spoke about archiving the internet, specifically the National Film and Sound Archive, including 10 Australian YouTube creators into the archive. Well, Mal says, my YouTube archiving nomination is for the Hindley Street Country Club out of Adelaide, a music collective with over 700 videos, a new one every week, 1.7 million subscribers at the moment. Year of the Cat 2 weeks ago has almost 600,000 views. Other examples include I Want to Know What Love Is, 39 million views. Well, that's it for Life Matters. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'll catch you again, this time tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.